Welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. Now, today's guest, Tim Hutchinson, is the co-founder and CEO of SkillsGPT. Tim started out in zoology before falling into a career in recruitment and then recently moving into the emerging world of AI. Tim now helps organizations harness the potential of generative AI to transform their organizations. So sit back as I seek to uncover fact from fiction in the new world of AI. Now, a quick shout out to our sponsors, Oasis Partners, corporate advisors with a practical bias. They may not know much about AI, but they do know a fair bit about getting a deal done. So if you're considering an exit, talk to the team at Oasis, 500 deals done and counting. So Tim Hutchinson, welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah. Glad to be here.
No, look, it's great. And I know we've known each other for a little while, but when I bumped into you recently, I thought we must get you in to have a chat about AI because I'm sure a lot of our listeners who are business owners and people in corporate are hearing lots of things about AI and generative AI and what it is and what it isn't. And I thought you being an expert, in fact, CEO of SkillsGPT, mm-hmm. I thought you might be a good guy, a good go-to guy to sort of try and unpack.
Let's hope so.
AI. So, yeah. Welcome.
I can certainly share my experiences, Mike.
Look, Tim, just going back, what's your journey and what got you into AI originally? I know that originally you had a sort of HR recruitment background.
So correct.
Tell us about that and how you've made the switch.
Absolutely. I'll try to shorten what is a relatively long story because I'm not in the first flushes of youth, Mike. So
you're a lot younger than me, by the way. So
having studied zoology originally, which was a bit of a left field educational background.
Now, for the uninitiated, including yes. me, what's zoology?
Well, take the zoo part and have a wild guess. It's the science of animals.
Is that right?
There we go.
So look, I presume the career options were fairly limited and you thought, I'm perhaps going to look outside of this area.
A little bit. At the time, so we're talking about 1990, the environmental movement was becoming very much fashionable from a corporate perspective.
Okay.
And I actually did a master's in environmental management.
All right.
Which was a highly, almost vocational degree.
Yeah.
And I went from that to be an environmental management consultant.
Okay.
With a large global construction firm.
Wow.
And we were essentially doing, so on the one hand, the construction firm was winning projects like the Hong Kong Harbour Crossing.
Yeah.
And there was separation between the divisions, but we were doing impact assessment work.
Okay, got it.
Related to that, those sort of things. I did that for 2 or 3 years. It says something about me because while I enjoyed the learning aspects, which is really, it's entirely a knowledge-based career, I did feel at the time it was too slow.
Right.
You had to really earn your stripes. It was,
okay.
The people above me had yeah. done 20 years hard times.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So I resigned.
Yeah, yeah.
So I almost fell, as a lot of people do, into the world of recruitment with Hayes in London
okay.
at the time. And frankly, absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And I loved it for the same reason I found the environmental work challenging, because recruitment is not slow.
No.
And recruitment in the 90s in London,
It was really taking off, wasn't it?
It was like a trading floor.
Yeah.
There were 100 of us
wow.
in one room. You know, shouting and screaming, but also learning real
right.
commercial
yeah.
realities, which I still lean on today.
Because, I mean, I think companies started outsourcing after that recession in 1990. So there's a huge outsourcing, get employees off your books.
Yeah.
And my brother built his recruitment business based on that, right, on contract labor. So he had hundreds of drivers or forklift truck guys. He had literally had hundreds of them out. He was taking a margin. But that, have we always had that permanent recruitment where you take a cut of the first year's salary? Has that always been around?
No, I think it became more popular around that time.
Did it?
Okay. Well, certainly 80s into the 90s.
Mm.
I mean, it is, although I probably have a love-hate relationship with recruitment.
Yeah,
I'm
sure.
You know, I spent 20 years in the industry, and the last 10 years until a couple of years ago was one of the owner directors of a tech recruitment firm in Sydney.
Right. Well, it's very mature now, so it's kind of become a bit commoditized, hasn't it?
Correct.
Whereas
yes.
early on, there was great margins and it
correct.
Was emerging and people were kind of using it and seeing value in it.
Correct.
Perhaps. And I suppose like a lot of things, it takes that I think it's called the Signet Curve, you know, it kind of flattens out and then everyone, you know, the world and his dog have figured it out and they're all cutting each other's throats, I suppose.
However, absolutely. However, the learnings from it, I still, you know, I talk to friends from Hayes days and whatever we're now doing, whether it's me as the CEO of an AI business or them in other walks of life, we still draw upon the, first of all, the work rate. We worked really hard. There was absolute, I'm going to use the word, brutal transparency over results. So the idea of measuring what matters was baked in 30 years before it became a, you know, a repeated saying.
So look, I mean, what got you into AI and what got you out of that more traditional? Because I mean, AI 10 years ago, you couldn't make a living doing AI 10 years ago, couldn't you?
I think, well, unless you were, I think, highly specialized and highly technical.
Ahead of the game.
Pioneering the things that we now see as widely available, I think. So,
So what got you into AI? And then I'm really interested in the difference between AI and generative AI. Like, I mean, is there a difference? Because everyone's talking about generative AI.
Well, we'll get to that. You give me some time to distill my thoughts. So what got me into AI? So just going back to that recruitment career, towards the end of my time in recruitment, this is sort of, I guess, 4 years ago, approximately 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
When I exited Ember, the recruitment company, we had noted a shift. This is when there was a real skill shortage, particularly in technical roles, and we were a tech recruitment company.
Right.
And clients had started to talk about, clients had perhaps started to open their minds, and rather than just transactionally saying, can you find us a head of cybersecurity?
Yeah.
They recognized that, first of all, there weren't unlimited heads of cybersecurity available.
Yeah.
And salaries were going up exponentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you get to a point where you're all poaching each other's people.
Yeah.
And the candidate moves, in some cases, for a 30K increment. Well, that can't go on indefinitely.
No.
Clients started to, with our help, break down roles into the actual skills, the buckets of skills people needed.
Okay.
And also to start to think about roles in that way. And this is the notion that has some traction now of the skills-based organization. Now, having hopefully an entrepreneurial mindset was exploring what that really meant and why that conversation was shifting.
Yeah.
And we became involved in a SaaS skills management business as part owners. It was a contact of mine in the UK had done the dev work and built this very rich skills taxonomy with 30,000 plus roles broken down into constituent skills.
Interesting.
With granular descriptors and mapped them and which at the time, and the world has changed again, at the time was, you know, essentially leading edge.
Yeah.
So we started to work with companies to try and help them using that SaaS software to understand their roles and their people by their skills. And then you start to do some of the whizzy stuff, overlays of those two things, and start to shift away from the idea of linear careers.
Right.
And think about a person, think about the whole person and what their capabilities might be.
Right.
Now, you may ask me how that went. Well, I now describe it as a period of heroic failure.
Okay.
Which I think...
We've normally got a few periods of them.
I was about to say, I reckon they're the good periods, as long as there's some heroic still and not just failure. Why do I say that? So first of all, we learned a huge amount, which I think is a theme hopefully of today, but also of today's world where this idea of continuous learning is becoming increasingly important.
Yes.
So we learned a huge amount, and we also actually transacted and delivered some really awesome work. We became skills consultants to one or two government departments.
Right.
And really sort of moved the dial in some of these areas. Where we were hamstrung, and it may, got to certainly take some of the responsibility, but the tech was in some ways clunky at that time.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is if you bring it down to a very simple example, to skills profile an individual, they themselves at some point ended up sitting looking at a skills taxonomy.
Right.
You know, it's phenomenally dull.
Right.
And I shouldn't be so blunt, but I am. So it's phenomenally dull. And people used to get to sort of the fifth skill in the list of 100 and start to zone out.
Okay.
And the other thing is, we're not necessarily self-aware about what our own skill sets are at a granular level.
Okay.
So people would traditionally think, I'm a marketing person.
Okay.
But if you ask them to break that down into 30 skills, quite difficult to do.
I mean, just on that point, I mean, marketing is completely splintered in terms of, or segmented really, hasn't it? I mean, if you look at marketing when I was first in business in the late 80s, you know, there were three or four core disciplines in marketing. And now there's like 35.
And far fewer channels to market as well.
Yeah, so you got this whole digital, so I mean that would be one area where there's been an explosion of, you know, where that whole idea of you know, buckets of skills, and that the role is actually, you know, we've got a role here now, Matt Smith, you just met him, but you know, Matt's doing four jobs, and we've begun to break down, okay, well, what are those four areas?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
At what stage do we have to specialize and bring in people to do that? Because I mean, most small businesses go through this where they have to kind of start thinking through, okay, well, you know, we can't keep doing, you know, people can't keep doing everything.
Absolutely. And there has to be there a level of self-awareness of the business as to what skills are required. And and we'll get onto this in the AI conversation particularly, because that's a lot of what's driving our work. But in terms of how I got into AI, one of the clients we were talking with at the time had been a successful tech entrepreneur.
Right.
And with the advent of, was it November, I'm going to say 22, with OpenAI and ChatGPT essentially, this widespread access to generative AI tools, we probably for about half an hour thought it might spell the death knell of what we were doing.
Right.
And then very quickly recognized that it could well be the unlock to the things I've described as problematic, an individual looking at a list of skills. It doesn't happen anymore because of the natural language interface.
Right.
You can have a conversation and skills can be inferred from that now. So these are huge shifts in what's possible. And very quickly, we were able to roll in, at the time, our sort of vertical expertise in skills, workforce management and all those related areas. Right, really from nose to tail, for want of a better phrase, from, you know, sourcing individuals for a company, onboarding them, understanding them, upskilling them, etc., that whole piece.
So that was 2022 when OpenAI came out with the whole kind of ChatGPT thing.
Correct. So at that time, we became, you know, I think you'd agree there's an element of luck and timing to a lot of things in life, but you keep striving, you keep working hard, you keep your eyes open to opportunity. And that conversation, that relationship has seen us become one of circa 15 companies in the ecosystem of a business called Innovate GPT. And Innovate GPT variously describes himself as a value add Gen AI venturing studio. So what they brought and bring to the party is very deep generative AI expertise with a lot of Microsoft alumni in the team. Access to capital where necessary, and perhaps most importantly, sort of a cross-pollination of ideas between the companies who are supported by Innovate. So if you think of a hub and spoke model, Innovate sit at that hub, and then us and other businesses are the spokes.
So what was the business? So in 2022, you know, OpenAI came along, produced ChatGPT, went from like zero to off the chart in no
fastest
time,
ever
right?
Uptake of technology to 100 million users, I think, in 3 months.
What was the business case coming out of that you spotted and said, okay, well, what's now needed is X?
I think we had people talk about falling in love with the problem. So our clients had, in their own way, many clients articulated their skills challenges, whether that related to hiring the right people, whether it related to trying to train people more quickly and more efficiently, whether it was about putting together powerful teams rather than, you know, based on some actual underlying knowledge. And also there was starting to be a trend of, which is really accelerating now, businesses are quite concerned or very concerned about the pace of change out there. And part of that, AI is part of the solution, part of the problem, frankly.
Yeah. Because, I mean, around that time, 22,
yes,
salaries were, like, there was a huge, the balance shifted to the employee after being with the employer probably for a long time, really.
Yes, yes.
And then all of a sudden the employees were able to start demanding. And there had been some wage stagnation, I think. I mean, we forget that. But there was a big catch-up going on there, I think. And employers, for the first time, you know, were really having to face the idea that they couldn't get people. And if they were going to get people, they're going to have to pay for them at levels they hadn't even dreamt of.
And although we'd moved away directly from the recruitment world, these were all recurring challenges. So I think what really crystallized a business case for us is that we'd already, although it's always shifting, we'd essentially defined the skills problem that organizations face. It's a basket of problems, essentially. So we'd fallen in love with the problem, but we're aware, as I said, that there were challenges in solving it with legacy tech. You know, things like a lot of the data, organizations for years in the HR space and the workforce space have been obsessed with collecting data. So there's vast amounts of siloed employee data, but very little insights found from it, and certainly not actionable insights. So I think, you know, we had, again, the benefit of the Innovate guys who had been building AI-based tools for a decade. You know, they were some of the early developers of, for example, what they would describe as very clunky booking systems on airline websites a decade ago. So they've really earned their stripes. So with their benefit as well and their knowledge, we were able to recognize what a massive unlock for some of these problems generative AI could be. Because of this ability to just essentially analyze vast amounts of structured and unstructured data, find the signals in the noise for the first time and sort of infer, as I said, either skills profiles or career pathways, etc. And allow users to interact without being expert in a system. You know, it was a huge, but of course at that time, and we now look back even 18 months down the line, and you realize how naive you are at every stage.
I suppose this is new, isn't it? I mean, you know, this is, I mean, 2002 we're talking about. But I mean, the business case, I mean, so, you know, people can download ChatGPT and get information. What you're saying, the business case was that you guys were able to provide a service that allowed you to do, you know, allowed you to help, you know, for your customers, for your clients. You're able to.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So how were you able to?
Let me. There are obviously multiple ways to adopt AI, and we're hopefully good people to talk about this because I'm very proud to announce that we. Or to share that we're one of four organizations granted a federal government grant under the AI Adopt scheme, where our goal over the next 3 years under that initiative is to help 75,000 regional SMEs to adopt AI in forestry, fisheries, agriculture, and clean energy. But to simplify in terms of that AI adoption piece, you know, what organizations are doing out there essentially is, and this is mirrored in a three-step process that we now apply. First of all, there's sort of a step one of trying to get people to a shared level of understanding of generative AI, get them a baseline understanding of what is this technology, what's possible, how fast is it changing? And amidst all the hype, the noise, what are the practical real world use cases that are starting to appear? We then help clients with a sort of a second step, which is we are absolutely of the opinion that AI initiatives should originate in the boardroom and not the server room. This is not a tech play in one sense. This is a business play. It's about working, in our instance, we work through a design thinking process with organizations. It's not a technical conversation. The goal is to have a number of sort of representatives from the organization, different disciplines, and try to capture what their big hairy problems are. I think it's a phrase, big hairy opportunities. And then distill that down into the most relevant use case to then go to step three and develop a proof of concept AI model for them. So this is really very deliberately starting off small and bite-sized, because you've got a very you've got a technology that is evolving weekly, daily. I mean, it's the pace of change is massive, which presents its own opportunities and challenges. And then you've got organizations all with their unique challenges. The solutions are not cheap, whatever that really means. So therefore, you can't, I mean, AI is fun. Everybody knows ChatGPT is awesome. It's fascinating. But you can't, as an organization, really head off on a vanity play. You've got to think about what success would look like, embracing, adopting AI, how you're going to measure that, what that return on investment looks like. So we try to work to that proof of concept to help people understand and see the art of the possible, and to start to get some metrics prior to scaling.
And is this predominantly about the data held by organizations and actually going to work on synthesizing that and making sense of that through tools? Or is it about more broadly looking at you know, what's available in the public domain and synthesizing that, or is it both?
It's a fair question. It's essentially both, but I think the real the really actionable insights and the really fascinating stuff happens when you're accessing the client's data. Because again, there are so many.
So this is data that's held, but not really been used.
There are so many. I mean, I obviously can't mention any names and have to be really careful. But you know, for example, you might talk.
Well,
about...
You can if you want. I mean, we won't tell anyone.
You get it in the edit.
We've only got six listeners, as they say.
Yeah, but who are they? you know, you can take, for example, a major retailer who, by their own admission, have to date been really achieving next to no insights from their sales data. And if you think about a retail organization who are, I mean, what are they doing? They're gathering data in real time at massive scale.
Yeah.
Through every point of sale, et cetera.
Mind you, if there's only two of you and you've got 70% market share, I suppose you don't, you know, it's a bit like being the government. It's a kind of tax on, so I mean, necessity is the mother of invention, isn't it? And generally it's the problems that drive the innovation and solutions, but it's good that they're waking up to that. But
well, let me give you an example then, which is probably a, not probably, would be a combination of those two broad sources of data you touch on. A lot of our work as Skills GPT is really trying to find opportunity in disruption for organizations, particularly around their workforce. Now, what I mean by that is, we've got some fairly massive disruptions happening. They are macro disruptions. So AI, the emergence of AI, of course, people are concerned about what that means to jobs. Mm.
So give an example of some of the disruptions that you're seeing.
I'll give you an example from a conversation yesterday where a client in the energy sector, because a lot of our work is moving to sectors such as under transition. So the transition to clean energy.
Yeah.
From legacy sources is a brilliant example of workforce disruption.
Okay.
Because you've got legacy jobs rolling off in simple terms from, the coal gas industries.
Yeah.
And you've got an increasing demand for people with knowledge and skills around renewables.
Okay.
You know, making connections to solar, to wind, etc.
So that's binary really. You're not talking, I mean, the disruption there is you're not switching a workforce. It's a new workforce and a new.
So that's a big external disruption happening. From a tech perspective. I was going to explain even in that instance. So there's that sort of macro disruption.
Yeah.
And then they so there are challenges there in terms of finding the right staff. They don't actually exist at scale with those renewables experience.
Okay.
So they're starting to look at efficiencies in the existing workforce as a starting point.
Yeah.
Even if you can find 1 or 2% efficiencies, it all helps.
Okay.
So, you know, at one point in time recently, they're looking for more people with scheduling, rostering, planning experience.
Yeah.
But 2 or 3 months down the track, recognize that some of the AI tools are able to perform that task.
Right.
So as opposed to needing people with rostering experience,
right,
you pivot, and what you actually need is people with the ability to right size those AI rostering models.
Right.
So that, and this
and they're different kinds of people. So they're, you're talking about technical people versus, you know, project management type people.
In simple terms, and this is where you start to think, well, what actually is, where does knowledge fit for people? Is it is it functional knowledge? Is it technical knowledge?
Yeah.
And this is, there is no answer to it because this is a rapidly moving piece. We're not building product at this stage.
No.
We're not building out of the box SaaS product because in most cases we're trying to find a highly effective point solution for a priority problem around workforce and then to develop from there.
Mm. Look, I mean, I suppose the real challenge is that, most of the probably listeners to this podcast are small business owners, right? About 40% of them are apparently. So there's, you know, hundreds of small businesses that are going, you know, they hear AI, they get the Fin Review, you know, they read articles like, will AI be a bust?
And surely not the binary press, yeah.
And so we're looking at, okay, how do I harness this? What's in it for me? Because, you know, you think about Woolworths or Coles and all their data and you go, okay, well, you know, you can play the long game. You can, you can invest in this. There's such a business case there. I mean, you can already see from the amount of data they must have. If you could start to do something with that dynamically and get insights and
the proven ROI is already massive.
Yeah, so it's off the chart.
Yes.
But was it, you know, your small business, they employ 50 people and they're trying to think through, okay, well, how do we harness this thing? Other than we've got ChatGPT on the desk or Microsoft Copilot and we're just plugging in questions.
Yeah, well, yeah. But even that actually, I mean, even that part. So, you know, if you think about ChatGPT, and I'm sure listeners are using it for various tasks at home and, dare I say, at work, but with the security concerns. Very quickly, small organizations started to get their own sort of secure instance through 365, so they therefore can have that conversation with ChatGPT securely. And it's a good point, because actually organizations, you start to the people who efficiently are finding good use for it are the workers. So if you actually ask people what they're using it for and have an open, honest conversation, that's where you learn the insights. And people will be using it for report writing. They'll be using it for structuring reports. They'll be using it for planning their week. Every possible sort of entry-level use, if you like. But I think what's happened is, I think you mentioned the newspaper there. You know, we have this strange binary press where you have to go through a hype cycle, don't you? Where first of all, it's incredible. It's going to solve all the problems in the world. And then a week later, it's going to be the end of all work.
Yeah, all jobs are gone.
Have to let that pass. And then, you know, now we're at a stage where companies are beginning to understand what's possible.
Yeah.
And trying to find these practical solutions. However, you know, I mentioned cost earlier, and actually for SMEs, there is a cost factor.
Yeah.
And in many cases we get a lot of requests from people who, I'll think of one very close to home the other week, a recruitment company who said to us, hey, we've of course got a CRM with 100,000 candidates on it. Could we, put that in their terminology, put that into AI and find interesting things?
Right.
Now the answer is yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Does it come at a cost? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And because of this pace of change in the world, you can't in good conscience stitch somebody a solution together and leave it with them.
No.
You actually need to then sort of offer a managed service to continually help that model develop.
Because it's a continuous improvement thing.
You know, there is a difference between... I'd say two things broadly, and they're objective, hopefully, and not in any selfish interest. One is with AI, the best thing to do is to get started. Now, let me clarify. I don't mean get started, start throwing money at the problem. I mean start learning about it.
Yeah.
Start reading about it. start trying to at least understand what it is. If anyone wanted to reach out on LinkedIn afterwards, we've got various resources that point to, you know, a nice checklist of 20 resources they can go to for free to start that learning journey.
Yeah.
Because I think you need to understand it first of all.
Yeah.
You know, and then the other piece is probably to talk to existing staff, because people will be using ChatGPT, and rather than pretending they're not from a security perspective.
So tell me about the security risk, right? So, you know, someone in a small business, say there's 20 staff, and half a dozen of them start, you know, they're using ChatGPT, and they haven't told anyone. Mm. So where are the risks for the business there?
Well, I think, I mean, the risk is that you are essentially sharing information publicly. So I remember quite early on we had, and it feels like a lifetime ago, but it was a year ago, a CFO was stood up in a meeting we were in and sort of laughing about it, said, oh, I've uploaded the annual accounts and I've started to get some insights.
Okay.
It's really, really not a good idea.
Wow.
Now, generative AI ChatGPT is not a search engine.
No.
So as such, that packet of information, that set of accounts isn't sitting there to be accessed in its entirety.
No, okay.
However, it's something of an unknown as to what aspects are. So absolutely you shouldn't be sharing sensitive information.
Yeah, okay.
But as we all know, straight censorship is not an answer to anything.
No.
So I think you need a discussion with staff and really understand.
Yeah, okay.
Because that's, again, going to that point about it originates in the boardroom, not the server room. Take the workforce as a proxy for the boardroom. Find out what people are using it for.
Yeah.
Find out where the efficiencies are. And the other thing I'd say, I quite like this, is I've got a colleague, Ray Fleming, who tries to explain generative AI in simple terms and says, treat it as an intern. Okay. I quite like it because if you think about an intern, you get the best out of them by giving them the best direction, simple, structured direction. Find value in the work typically quickly, but you typically or should check the work. And that's very much the same with generative AI. You know, there are phenomenal insights, but I think you do have to also take it with a pinch of salt because of hallucinations people will have heard of, and make certain that you're either applying your own critical thinking, or the guys who've built the models for you have thought about how the information that's surfaced is verified, and against what.
So, can you give us some examples, Tim, of you know, good use cases where, you know, the ability to do some of the things that you've been talking about has really helped a business, you know, transform?
I can. This is where I have to be careful, because some of the detail is very specific. I'm going to give you an example that was a very early use case that we prototyped, because I think it, in one sense, it's very simple, and in the other sense, it's also it's very much a people first example, which I like. I don't want to give deeply technical examples. So we were working with an organization who are essentially helping disadvantaged job seekers to secure work. So disadvantaged for a range of reasons, but sometimes mental health challenges, socioeconomic challenges, etc. Now, and it talked about a large organization. Now, the challenge they had is that despite working hard and wanting to do the best by their clients, it often ended up as a somewhat binary matching exercise. So if somebody had done some cleaning work in the past, they would look through their opportunities and find a cleaning job. It achieves something. It also misses out on that point I made about
other things
is this
they
person?
Could do. Yeah, yeah.
What do they aspire to? What are their motivations?
Yeah, okay.
What else are they capable of? Now, again, as I said earlier, that's a cohort of people who perhaps find it harder than others to self-select and understand what their aspirations or their skills are.
Yeah.
Now, we then applied generative AI to both sides of that, the supply and the demand piece of that problem. So on the demand side, the the job seeker, we're able to build something called role narrator.
Okay.
Which essentially, they had a conversation, an actual conversation, not even a typed conversation, based on a series of questions, which really focused on just what they enjoy in life and what work they've done and what they enjoyed about that work.
Okay.
No pointed questions around what are your skills.
Sort of open questions. More
really open,
getting
conversational.
Them to express themselves, yeah.
Now, from that, you can very effectively infer what somebody's skills are.
Right.
But perhaps as importantly, or more importantly, what are their motivations? What are their aspirations? What are their fears about work? Whole range of things. Now, if you do that as well, not so much a conversation, but if you start to look at the roles on the supply side and think about them again beyond the job title and what the attributes are, you start to find adjacencies.
Yes.
And, you know, there were some very, very specific examples where, you know, somebody in that instance who was aspergic had made a comment around preferring to work alone. And it seems really simple, but they'd actually been overlooked for a whole range of cleaning roles in the cleaning instance. Because, of course, there's people in the offices, etc. But then it started to think about some of the skill sets, some of the skills around handling equipment or handling certain chemicals, whatever it might have been. And, you know, a role pops up, which I think from memory was, it was certainly a night shift role, which might seem obvious, but people don't make these connections at scale normally. And it was in a completely different discipline.
No, that's good. And you know, I really like that example. So ostensibly, you've got these, you know, you're breaking down a role from a title into a bucket of skills, and then you're getting much more insight into the candidates and what it is that may have done in the past, or what they could do, what they like, what they don't like. And then you're trying to intuitively put that together in a way that it wasn't being done before.
Absolutely.
Because I mean, what little I know about recruitment is, it's so easy to get pigeonholed in any recruitment, never mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you know, often, you know, we'll talk to people who really want to make a move. It's in a traditional recruitment sense, it's very difficult.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
If not impossible, you know.
And I mean, I've given a recruitment example essentially, and I need to make it clear that we've moved far beyond recruitment and, you know, broadly talking about workforce. But even a recent example, you know, if you take any of these industries that are transforming rapidly, and I will mention the energy one again, because it's really the largest global initiative of all time, the shift to clean energy. Now, when you talk to clients in that space, even forget the internal challenges they have around workforce, they're very aware that they don't necessarily know what they don't know about the sector they work in. And what I mean by that, you know, there's vast amounts of information out there about battery energy storage systems, about solar projects, all of this stuff. You can now assimilate that information at scale and start to make, you know, as is insights around demand and project demand and hence workforce demand, but also you can start to make predictive ideas about, well, where is our industry heading? What might that mean in terms of the skills required, headcount required, the costs, and what are the levers that are going to impact that? Now, what you find is when you start to look, you start to see things. And, you know, in that instance, you have a new challenge evolves, which is the biggest lever in that external piece is regulatory landscape, which you can't really necessarily dictate. So then you have to look at, well, what can we? Again, what do we measure to allow us to plan ahead? And a lot of organizations are remarkably in the dark currently.
I mean, there's a lot of talk about AI taking out jobs and, you know, the workforce going to be dramatically affected. And, you know, those predictions were being made in the late 80s with the advent of the computer, really. I mean, there was a lot of talk about,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, when I left school, there's 10% unemployment. If you're under 25, that was about, don't know, 25%. And so there was a lot of talk about computers are going to take over and there's going to be no jobs. And yet we haven't seen anything like that, have we, really? So, I mean, AI is now talking about that as well, but it's going to take it. Now, I mean, is that going to happen? Or in fact, are we just going to see a pivoting, really, and a redistribution of work?
Honestly, I think it's hard to predict because you'll hear every variation of the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely categorically, certain jobs will disappear.
Yeah.
And other jobs will significantly change in terms of their profile.
Right.
But does that lead to wholesale loss of people? I don't think so, because for probably broadly for two reasons. One is that that pace of change just does not impact that quickly. Right. People are, you know, there's inertia in the system. People, organizations are slow to adapt. Perhaps rightly so.
I mean, and you wonder where the triggers are. I mean, if you take, I mean, when you get to my age, you can look back a bit. So the, if you look at websites that have been spoofed in the 90s as the answer to everything.
Yes.
And, you know, I kept, you know, being convinced that I had to look at it, and then I'd have a go online, and then, you know, I'd see the dial-up. Do you remember the old dial-up? We'd go,
yep.
And it would take like 5 minutes to load a page.
Yes.
And it was like a brochure online, and I remember thinking, what a lot of fuss about nothing. And then everyone was going on and on about that. And literally from the early 90s right the way through 2000, and then it the whole penny dropped when the iPhone appeared in 2008. And all of a sudden, we went to commerce.
Yes.
And speed and convenience.
Yes.
And that was a catalyst for a massive change. I mean, look at the amount of commerce done online now.
Absolutely.
So,
but look at what that's led to in terms of allied industries.
Exactly.
You know, so you wonder, warehousing, logistics, distribution, et cetera. Yeah.
So what are the triggers, you know, for AI maybe? You know, what's going to make the wholesale change there in terms of adoption and utilization? It's hard to know, isn't it?
Honestly, I think it's very hard to predict. I think... I mean, in practical terms, I would say to organizations, again, this is not going anywhere. So I think...
So get hold of it, educate yourselves.
Get hold of it, understand what people are doing.
Begin to start trialing stuff slowly, methodically, you know, what can we do?
And at an individual level, the same, this sort of idea of, you know, lifelong learning. You know, it's an oft-repeated phrase now, but that you're not going to lose your job to AI. You're going to lose your job to somebody using AI. And, you know, people are very, it's, again, go back to that intern idea. It's almost as if each employee has an intern supporting them. Now, if you get that right, there are just massive efficiencies and upside. You know, whether they're, I mean, you can, it's hard to come up with examples on the fly, but you can look at certain industries where there will be wholesale change. But actually, you talk to people in those industries, they don't necessarily, they can't necessarily predict where that will end. So take something like the legal profession, for example. I was with a group of lawyers the other day who both have a legacy law firm, traditional successful law firm, and also are moving into the generative AI space. Now they've almost done a parallel run, an A-B split testing on work that they do repeatedly. And I think roughly they'd said it would take a team of 4 people 3 weeks traditionally. They've now got that down to 20 minutes with an AI model. Now, clearly that's a fundamental change. What does that mean?
Well, either the fees go down or they keep hold of the fee. I mean, that's the thing is, does it get commoditized?
That's probably a journey where the fees probably remain relatively high and then erode as it becomes more apparent that that's the case. But for the lawyers, you know, they've gained back a lot of time there. So is there, you know, the simple answer is that there's value add work they can be doing. I did hear, I've got to be careful here as well, so I'll edit this a little bit. Very early on again, and I'm talking a couple of years ago, I was talking to a CIO of a fashion business who was very ahead of the generative AI curve. And partly because their CEO was essentially from that world previously.
Yeah, the chief information officer, right?
Yeah, so the CEO was from an AI world previously, okay. And then the CIO therefore had that influence early on. The CIO, quite a bit of a character, had presented to the design team and others around generative AI.
Right.
And in real time, typed in some of their design cues as an organization,
yeah,
and asked it to produce an item that they typically produce.
Yeah.
And it did so.
Okay.
And it was arguably, well, certainly it was very similar to what they produced previously, designed. Right. And I'm being careful with my detail. But actually in many ways was better. And he deliberately left them sort of looking glum for a while.
Cogitating on that.
As if, right, well, that's us done. And then a bit like in a reality show where they start, they then turn up the colour and turn up the arousing music in Grand Designs or something. He does the uplifting part where he says, hey, you know that thing on our sort of to-do list that we've all wanted to get to, which is looking at a new sustainable material to replace leather?
Now we can do it.
We've never got to it, have we?
No.
We could be doing this. So there's this,
adding value, more creative,
hopefully
stuff.
Doing the work we're more interested in.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I'm an optimist at heart, and I think that's an exciting future.
Yeah.
Will there be collateral damage along the way?
Yeah.
Of course. But I heard an example the other day as well from, you mentioned computers in the 80s. The chap I saw presenting was talking about the motor car at the turn of the century. Whenever it was, you know, late 1898, 1900. And, you know, there was something like 30 or 50,000 people working in the horse stabling industry in London.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now the motor car came along.
Yeah.
There were fewer horses.
Yeah.
Now, what happened? That happened over a period of time.
No.
Blacksmiths started helping in the car industry.
Yes.
Etc. So, you know, look, I'm not the person to predict, and I think anybody who does.
Look, who are the winners here? I mean, if you look at OpenAI, right? I heard the other day, they started out as not for profit, but I heard they flagged the other day they're going to a profit model, right? So who are going to be the winners here, right, in terms of the economic model, and who's going to kind of, you know, are the big tech guys going to own this space, and we're all going to get the scraps? Or in fact, is it going to be a genuine democratization of publicly available information?
It's possibly a bit of both. It sounds like a fudge, but bear this in mind. So, in so many areas of technology, technology has been pioneered by the small niche players and subsequently acquired by the big tech.
Yeah.
This is one of the first instances where it's the exact opposite. So almost overnight, big tech have released this phenomenally powerful technology, and it's now the smaller players who are trying to work out what to do with it and how to commercialize it best. Now, where that will lead to, my best guess is, as in a lot of industries, you will end up with people with highly specialized niche capability that's highly effective.
Right.
So the guys who are pioneering, for example, looking at radiography or cancer scans and doing very niche work there very effectively in terms of identifying cancers. Of course, there's commercial upside in that whilst doing good work. But you'll also have presumably a handful of big players who win in the space.
Yeah.
So if And again, another cliche, the idea of selling shovels to gold miners. I mean, look at NVIDIA and their chips and their share price. Well, they're so well placed to service the entire industry, regardless of what the use cases are.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, I think in our world, it's a very good point as sort of, you know, founder of a scaling generative AI business. We have to think about these, where our commercial future is. And in some ways, that's you certainly can't determine that hard and fast from day one.
No.
So I think what we try to do amidst the noise is to pick out the things that are tangible. So, for example, that grant win delivering AI.
Yes.
Helping 75,000 organizations adopt AI. And if you want to see more about that, you can check out arain.com.au, Australian Regional AI Network. That for us is an enormous opportunity.
Right.
Because amidst all the noise and all the hype of generative AI, that's a vote of confidence in us, and it's a tangible roadmap to helping organizations at scale.
Wow.
Some of these initiatives may ultimately lead into, you know, repeatable use cases that then lead into product. And we're almost doing some of the market testing you know, with a large cohort, if you like. What we're very aware of, we cannot be all things to all people. So I think it's one of those businesses, certainly for us, we're running our business with no sacred cows, as they say.
Yes.
So I think the best thing we can do as a leadership team is put everything on the table every quarter.
Yeah.
And determine, again, to measure what matters, determine our direction.
Yeah.
And, you know, put our efforts into those things that have future.
In some ways, we're back to the beginning. We're applying timeless principles to, you know, to technology, hard work, measurement, results, you know, figuring out how something can be harnessed to be useful and constructive and positive. And
absolutely remembering people in human in the loop. People are critical. Yeah.
And there are downsides everywhere, like there is with everything, including the internet. But if we, you know, if we can keep, you know, if we can keep positive and constructive, we can perhaps, you know, carve out a better future. It's certainly been the history of mankind, really, is that we have found a way to move forward, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would honestly say to people, I'm probably repeating myself, but I think, you know, if you're an organization wondering about AI, interested in AI, terrified by AI, whatever it might be, don't worry about the technology for the moment, other than, I think, accepting that it's here to stay. And will be ultimately have a bigger impact, I think, than the internet.
Yeah.
But don't worry about the tech. Park that bit of conversation and think about your business. And think about those areas where you deem there to be really significant opportunity, or that have been the bottlenecks to growth. Now, despite running an AI business, I'm repeating another phrase you hear a lot: just because you have a very large AI hammer doesn't mean that everything is an AI problem.
Right.
So it's not the solution to everything.
No.
But the starting point is to identify the business challenge and to work back from there and determine whether and to what extent AI might produce a new unlock to that problem.
Right.
And that's where you then start to actually find tangible benefit, or determine that at this stage or for your business, it's not appropriate.
Yeah, I get it. That's interesting. Look, fascinating, Tim. And on the subject of lifelong learning, I mean, that idea that we've all got to become kind of lifelong learners and students, I think. And now with the democratization of intelligence and information, really, you know,
via
the internet, we've got so much more available to us.
I wasn't going to interrupt, Mike. I was reflecting on something walking down here, which is in some ways, as a 50-something chap, I'm a bit of an example of this idea of lifelong learning. And I kind of reflect the pace of change in the world. So, you know, I obviously studied early on in life. I imagine I learned a few things in the interim. However, I kind of got busy with work. It's in this last 3 or 4 year period where I've massively embraced the idea of learning. And I am loving it because my brain feels just alive. And but I think a lot of people suffer from imposter syndrome, don't they? And they sort of feel they can't enter a new world or they're not worthy of it. I heard a stand-up comedian the other day saying, these people don't have imposter syndrome. What they don't realize is they're suffering from a healthy dose of self-awareness. So in fact, we don't know a lot of stuff. And I think it perhaps comes with age or something where I no longer care whether I know what I need to know in a situation, because most people don't know everything. And there's a lot, what I'm getting to, I think, is saying this pace of change in the world is in some ways great because nobody's got all the answers. So I'm in meetings where I've gone back to basics, where I'm applying perhaps recruitment skills. I ask questions in a humble, unafraid manner. Might be a bloody basic question, I have no idea, but I ask the question and I listen to the answer. And I think that's a good way of looking at AI, which is try and understand it, try and explore, and, you know, get involved, because people don't have all the answers.
No.
You know, if something's released you know, constant new releases on a weekly basis, you can know as much as anybody else in a week's time.
Yeah. Look, Tim, thank you for that. Look, it's a fascinating world ahead of us, and you know, we certainly got to be alive and awake, haven't we? And I'm very grateful for you coming in today and sharing with us your insights. We'll put your details in the show notes.
I appreciate the opportunity, Mike.
And we wish you well at Skills GPT.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye. So there you have it, generative AI. Thanks to Tim for helping unpack how AI is being developed at the practical level. And whilst the future is always uncertain, what's not uncertain is that AI is going to be part of it. That's for sure. If you want to chat with Tim at Skills GPT, the details are in the show notes. Now, a final shout out to Oasis Partners, our generous sponsors of this podcast. Oasis help the shareholders of private companies wishing to exit strategically. So, if you want to know more about what they do, talk to Don Hunton, the CEO of Oasis. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please tell your friends. And if you're feeling generous, leave a like. Until next time, take care.